Hi guys, and welcome to episode 15 of the Breadwinners Podcast. I am your host, Pori Kilfordy. This business podcast looks into the lives of current entrepreneurs and business owners on how they have navigated their way to being the best they can be and what really makes them tick. I look into their highs, their lows of their journey, and what helpful tips they can give. This week on the program, I'm joined by Katrina Ellis from Premier Property Solutions. Katrina's career is an interesting one from start to finish, with some real life moments that pushed her to starting up her own business in property and financial wellness. Katrina's unique story delves deep into her life and business, from having it all to her biggest mistakes and her biggest wins. Let's jump into episode 15 of the Breadwinners Podcast.
And you're very welcome to the Breadwinners Podcast. Business people, business owners, wannabes, entrepreneurs wannabe, or people who just want to make a difference. And I think, suppose that's what we try to do with the podcast on a monthly basis, to give you the content that you really need to help you thrive. And well, at the minute, like everybody else, survive is the important thing. Well, one girl who is surviving and she's thriving, but it just hasn't been as easy as it looks. And still on that journey is Katrina Ellis. Katrina, thank you very much for joining me on the Breadwinners Podcast. It's great to have you on. And first of all, tell our listeners who you are and what exactly you do.
Thanks very much, Pádraig, for having me on. My name is Katrina Ellis. I'm originally from Ireland, a little place called County Laois, and I've been living in the Isle of Man for the last 5 years. I'm coming from a corporate background in banking for 10, 15 years or so between a number of countries, Ireland, UK and Australia, and left the corporate world back in 2011 after my son was born. So been doing that, my primary caregiver role for the last number of years. Conscious decision, happy to do it. But last March, we lost our only income, and that threw the cat amongst the pigeons, to say the least. And that catapulted me back into searching for another income and how that we might bring that about, because my husband is an airline pilot, and as you will have seen in the media, that industry is one that's been pretty much obliterated over the last year. So whilst he has his job back at the moment, it's very uncertain as to whether it will remain or not. So I set myself out using my background as to see what other things I could start bringing in. So in the last year, I've dusted off some qualifications. I've got my financial advisor qualification back again, and I've also studied and qualified as an estate agent. Did it in record time of 2 months, with an average of 18 to 24 months. But I like to put a bit of pressure on myself, so got that one out of the way, and set up a property company, and also a company which deals with women's wealth. So I've got a few hats on, but I'm very much in the kind of finance money space, and whatever is going to work towards creating that diversified income in my house, that we never have to have exposure to what we experienced last year. So I think that's pretty much it. I'm building a portfolio in terms of property. I have a few in Ireland. I'm building a portfolio in the Northeast. That's something particular passionate about, but all things money and finance are what I really get lit up about.
Yeah, and I suppose that took you about 3 minutes to say, but you've gone through about four or five new qualifications over the last number of months, so hats off to you. And sometimes I suppose when we get into the background of your story, but it's when those situations come about that you really find that inner drive that you have. Maybe explain that to me, because that was, let's just say, that was when the shit hit the fan and there was no more shit and there was no fan. So you really had to dig deep. Talk us through what was going through Katrina's mind then, back this time last year.
Well, I'd have to be that's what happened after. And it would be remiss, I think, of me to ignore when the shit actually hit the fan, what actually happened, because I think that's in an effort to keep it real. When the shit actually hit, I was in the middle of a property course in the UK. My husband and kids were on the island. And my initial thought was, shit, don't close the borders before I get in, because I don't want to be, you know, separated from my family. That would just make things a lot worse. I want to be back with my, in my safe house with my kids and my husband. And, you know, we would deal with it together. So that was my initial concern, was that I need to get back. And I literally got back. There were two boats after me and that was it. Then the border was closed and people just couldn't get in for months. So that was my initial fear. We got past that, landed home, and then it was like, right, what are we going to do? And for the first, I'd say 10 days, we just put it to the side, because we were in shock as to, we had no idea what we were going to do. And I focused for those 10 days on just getting out of bed. I was paralyzed. My head was well and truly, you know, kept dipping beneath the water. I was getting anxiety attacks in my chest. I thought I was having some kind of attack. And it was just overwhelmed with anxiety and stress as, how the hell are we going to dig ourselves out of this? But I knew it was a fruitless task to try and G myself up at that point. I knew what I needed to do was just be still, you know, get through the day, focus on eating, sleeping, and just keeping the boat on an even keel until I knew I had myself in a place mentally to actually, you know, pull my socks up and go, okay, right, now what are we going to do? But those first, I'd say, 7 to 10 days, Joe Wicks was one person who played a massive role in me getting out of bed even. He got me out, because I'd made a pledge to the kids that we were going to do it every day. And any day Joe Wicks was on the on YouTube, I was there, because I couldn't let the kids down. So I was there for my half an hour, you know, 5 days a week. And I'd never been so fit doing that. But that physically played a massive part for me, and mentally, because that got the happy hormones going. It got me physically out of bed. I was, you know, responsible for that. And I was showing up. Got my half an hour, and every single day that kind of built me up physically, mentally, and happy hormones got going. Every day we would make sure that we were eating well, we were sleeping well, and we would go for a walk after lunch every day. So we had a good, nice structure to the day, even though everything else was in absolute chaos. We tried to keep some kind of structure and regularity to our days. And then when I felt mentally in a place to go, okay, right, what are we going to do with this now? This is real. This is not going away. We have no sense as to when, you know, this is going to get corrected. And my husband at the time, he knew that he felt that this would be kind of fixed pretty quickly. It would be okay, because it was his job and his absolute passion in what he does. But I just, for whatever reason, had a feeling this was big. This was going to go on for quite some time, and this wasn't going to be easy to rectify. So he was hanging his hat on getting his income restored. And I knew immediately that wasn't going to be happen for some time, for however reason. I knew, I don't know, just woman's intuition, gut feeling, whatever you want to call it. I just knew there was something bigger at play. So once I got myself to that place of even keel, I was like, okay, what are we going to do? So we worked through, thankfully, we'd spent the previous 5 years to that actually putting in place financially a number of layers of protection. So we had an emergency fund, we had savings for the kids, we had several different savings pots, thankfully. So we were able to get, you know, we had the protection in place to pay the mortgage, because we didn't have furlough here. My husband was furloughed, but what we received from the government here was £200 a week. So, and that was nowhere near sufficient to cover our mortgage, our food, our utilities, and we stripped everything back to our basics. So we had the comfort of that, having spent several years getting it all in place, so we could relax. We knew money. Okay, it wasn't ideal that we were raiding our savings, but at least we had the wherewithal to actually, you know, get through it and pay our mortgage. We didn't want to take our mortgage holiday because we were concerned about the effect it would have on our credit rating and add, you know, to our total debt. So we didn't want to go that route if we could avoid it. So we eventually got ourselves, you know, we figured, okay, well, we've got X amount of months to expenses covered. So we've got this window now. We need to pull our fingers out and figure out what we're going to do. So my husband, he set his stall out on, you know, working to see what he could do in terms of his job and whatever. And then I turned a different direction and thought, well, what can I do? So I went back to my banking roots, pulled out my old qualifications, had forgotten, actually, would you believe that I was a qualified financial advisor until I pulled the certificate get out. And I thought, oh God, I am a financial advisor, but of course it had lapsed. So I thought, right, well, that's one thing I can do. And that's definitely something that's going to be in demand, given the world is in chaos financially also. And then property was something I'd literally just finished the course on. And I thought, okay, right, this needs to be jump-started quickly into place. So I got on that and just started making connections and every day giving myself a couple of little steps to do and just kept going. And we went one way and then we zigged another way. And eventually we landed on our plan as to what way we were going to go, and just baby step by baby step, I just kept putting one foot in front of the other, and some days were easier than others. But you know, we eventually made a plan, got there. We had lots of obstacles. There was, you know, obstacle after obstacle, particularly on the property stuff here in the island, because the compliance requirements were insane. But we just kept going because my eyes were on that end game of, we cannot let this pain happen again. It was just off the scale. And I'm never, ever exposing our family to that vulnerability again. This will be rectified for once and for all. And I set my stall out on several different income pieces so that we'd be well diversified if anything like this were ever to happen again. So that was my thought process and how I worked through it.
Just looking at your body language when you started to tell me about the whole scenario of doing a property course and two boats away from getting back home for, look, it could have been a couple of months. This is not business related or property related. It's more emotionally related. Can you dig a bit deeper on that for me? Just where was Katrina's thought pattern at that stage? Was it?
It was fear. I mean, there was so much unknown at that stage as to, you know, how it was contracted, how dangerous it was. There was so much fear in the media. All I saw, and because I was lucky in that I was locked away for 4 days, so I wasn't exposed to the vast majority of it. But there was just this sense in the air. And, you know, I was happened to be at a table with four people, my friend and two others. And I distinctly remember at one stage sneezing, just because I sneezed. I was in an air conditioned room and whatever. And the looks on the other people of my face, they physically jumped away from me because they were feeling something similar, I guess, in terms of, oh, my God, she might have corona. She's just sneezed and we're at her table. You know, are we also infected? So it was just, the air was just fear. And I definitely picked up on that. I'm not somebody who generally jumps on bandwagons like that. I tend to, you know, to have my own mind on things. But I couldn't escape that at that stage because it was just seemed to be permeating everywhere I went. And on the boat, waiting for the boat, you know, everybody was there trying to get the last boat back to make sure, because we didn't know when the government was going to close the borders, which was a very real threat. And, you know, it was just, you know, I really desperately, the one place I need to be, this is my safe, my happy place with my family. These are the most important people in my life. And I don't want to be the other side of that sea. I want to, whatever. And I'm the kind of person who, you know, even if I had missed the last boat, I would have gotten in. I would have found a way. There was no way, you know, Mama Bear kicked in and there was no way I would get away from my kids. So I made sure that, you know, I got on that boat and I made sure I was in time before those borders closed. But it was just fear, I'd say, was the number one thing in my mind. But driven by that mama bear instinct to, I need to get home and I'll do whatever I have to do, beg, borrow, steal to get my ass back to my family. And then as soon as I landed, I remember just release and just crying and just with sheer relief, I'm back in my home with my kids, my husband, and okay, the shit has hit the fan, but we're fine. We're together. We're in our safe, happy place. We'll be fine. We'll work it out. So as soon as I landed, just the relief, remember my shoulders drop and thinking, oh my God, I am so happy and grateful to be back here. It'll be okay. We'll be fine. We'll work it out.
Take me back, Katrina, to your earlier days in business. Suppose you were in the corporate banking and no doubt, obviously, there would have been some patterns of last year that would have, you know, came about as well in 2006 and 2008, when everyone was buying everything and it was, here's 100% mortgage, here's 110, here's 120. Can you take me back to that, those particular times? Suppose when the boom was happening, was there any, you know, was there any signs of the, you know, when you were working within the bank and the bank structure that they were going, hang on a minute, lads, we need to pull a handbrake up here?
I was one of those people. I have two 100% mortgages. At that time, I didn't go for one. I thought, no, I'll go for two. Right. And for a long time, personally, on those, actually, I felt a lot of shame and guilt about having those. But having studied, the wealth stuff for the last few years, actually, I think they're a gift. Now, thankfully, they worked out well for us and we were able to keep on top of the payments, etc. But, you know, there's none of my money in those mortgages. So, you know, it's infinity returns, as they say, in terms of those properties for me. So I'm very glad that those worked out for me. But in terms of the bank and what, I mean, I was working in retail sales. And we were in the office where, we were setting the targets for the branches around the country. And the executives at that level, I mean, I was interacting with, some of the top execs. And we used to have the weekly sales calls and whatever. And, you know, they got beaten up a lot, I feel, for irresponsible lending. And that's not something I saw personally. And I never saw, sales being driven at, all or nothing kind of basis. To me, it was done quite responsibly. I am always in the corner of every individual who applied for those mortgages. You know, they knew what they were doing in the vast majority of cases. And there was responsibility on both sides. So, you know, I disagreed with a lot of media that it was all the bank's fault. I felt, no, there's two parties playing here. There's the applicant who's taken that out. They knew whether it was within their means or outside. And they needed to take a sense of responsibility for that as well. But equally, obviously, the banks, you know, but I think the balance, you know, was delivered unfairly in the media in terms of delivering it all at the bank store. And I don't know whether that's, I'm a bit biased having been an ex-bank employee, but that's not what I saw. I worked for one of the top Irish banks, and it was, it's a bank that survived. I felt they dealt, you know, relatively responsibly with what was happening. Was there holes? Absolutely, of course there was. I didn't get a sense of that greed and drive it at all at any costs. But maybe it was in the department or the area that I was working in. I don't know. But I would definitely been in the minority, I'm sure. Having that perspective, and probably most would think that, well, you were in the bank, you're working for the bank, of course you're going to have that opinion. But it's a discussion I have on a regular basis with my husband in terms of the responsibility and where the guilt lay. I don't know, for me it's everybody has responsibility in that occurrence, everybody had a role to play, I think.
Yeah, and I suppose it was probably colleagues of yours that, you know, got the brunt of it. And I suppose it's interesting that this side of it has never really been spoken about, well, to a certain degree, but the media obviously wouldn't take that story because it's just not the narrative they like to portray to the general public, maybe. But you see it from both sides now. As you're into property, you understand that there's high risk as well, potentially, if you do it wrong. Hands up here, I got it completely up the left whenever I was in starting off my investment journey, but you know, I probably bought at the wrong time, probably got too much money, and yes, you're right, probably was irresponsible when I did do that. So where's Katrina's thinking now? Is it still pretty much the same that, look, if you're going to be borrowing money, you have to know what you're doing with?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm definitely in the camp at all stages of my life of taking responsibility. You know, I'm not somebody who, you know, I've had my screw ups absolutely along the way. You know, and at one point I did feel that two 100% mortgages were screw ups, but now with hindsight, I think actually, you know what, they're actually pretty damn lucky to have those. But always along the way, I wouldn't have shifted responsibility. Even now, I know a lot more than I did then, and I would still feel that it would be reckless of me to enter into any position in terms of taking out lending that I knew in my heart that I could not, I couldn't service the debt. And, you know, I definitely, I suppose, more savvy now in terms of making sure that going into anything with eyes wide open, that I have an exit strategy, that I'm very aware that I have minimized the risk where possible. That isn't something I would have, the properties we have in Ireland, they would have happened accidentally. Like, we bought one in North County, Dublin, as our home at the time. went to try sell, then it was a bad time to sell. So we just held on to it and rented it. It was in a great location to rent. So fell into that, then bought a house. You know, we moved from Dublin down to Laois. Bought a lovely detached house for the family, three kids, nearer to my parents for support. And then we kind of, I suppose, again, an opportunity, we fed up of paying the high tax in Ireland, getting nothing in return. Opportunity came up for husband and we decided to move. So again, we had this other property that wasn't going to sell at the time. So we held on to it again and rented it out. But at each stage, you know, of all those decisions, I wouldn't have been pushing the blame on the market because it wasn't selling, the estate agent because he wasn't doing his job, whatever. There's always, it's always back to me. And so, okay, well, you know, you always have choices and you either choose to take responsibility for whatever the situations you're in and choose the actions, you know, to best suit where you are and what it is that you want as the outcome. So I don't think my thinking has probably shifted largely on it. But I'd say I'm probably more savvy in terms of making sure that I've minimized the risk as much as I possibly can and that I have an exit strategy planned as well, if needs be, you know, should the unforeseeable happen.
And would you see, Katrina, I suppose, now some of the same old features from before coming back into the sector, the property sector, the finance sector, where there's signs that there could be mistakes being made, maybe. As we see in Ireland at the minute, you know, there's council flats being bought up for 600,000. You know, pushing, I suppose when you look at it from an open book point of view, it's where we were back in 2011. Property prices are through the roof. People can't get, you know, obviously a home in a country that they really love. Have to move out, maybe, you know, God forbid you want to live in Dublin if you're from Dublin, but you have to move out of Dublin because obviously the supply is not there. Is there too much heel dragging going on here? Do you feel there's something more? Maybe there's a trick that we're not actually doing and implementing, because there is opportunities there for people if the government decide to make it happen.
I don't know. I'll be totally honest and say I'm not totally up to speed with where things are at in terms of property market in Ireland. We do have two still in the country, but it's not something I'm very au fait with. But I suppose my take on it would be is if I were in somebody's shoes who's trying to get on the property ladder, I would always be of the opinion that where there's a will, there's a way. And, you know, if I had to take my money that I have from a deposit, go put it elsewhere for the moment and maybe do some flips somewhere else, perhaps in the northeast of England, and you're getting your money, you know, you're slowly building up a bigger deposit with the initial pot that you have, which is not going to do anything for you in Ireland, but you could potentially, you know, multiply that quicker by using it, you know, in a different strategy, in a different location, and getting the money together that you need. So I would always look for options, because I'm of the opinion as well, I suppose, that always from a long time back, maybe 10, 12 years ago, doing some mindset study stuff with some leaders in that area of thinking, remember learning about the differentiation between my economy and that economy. And anything to me, I don't pay a huge amount of attention to what goes on in the news. It's not something I watch. I sometimes look at the headlines and that's about it. That's all I need to know, because I find the tone and the content so negatively biased that it's not helpful in any way. So I focus on my economy, within my locus of control, and if there are key things that the government are doing, etc., that are, you know, impact me, well then I'll just shape shift around them to get what I want. So I always think, no matter what the situation is, I would always approach it from a problem solution point of view and go, look, okay, well, what are my options here? Never say never. There is always a way around it, you know, whether you have to work with a parent or family member in the short term to get yourself in the property ladder, whether you have to open your mind to other opportunities. Like we upsticked back, whatever, 5.5 years ago now with our kids, because we were in a position where we were just about making ends meet. You know, 50% of my husband's salary was going on tax. We were getting diddly squat in return. And we just thought, okay, we can continue spinning our wheels here and getting bloody well nowhere, or we can make a massive move, rip three kids away from the only family that they know besides their parents. And it was a huge it was a huge move to make at the time because our kids were relatively small, but they were very attached to grandparents and family there. But for the sake of what we were trying to build, that was a decision we had to make. We could still be there moaning and groaning about the level of the tax rate and, you know, how we can't save and la la la, but it was in our hands again. It was our responsibility. We could either suck it up or we could do something about it. And I'm always in the camp of, you know, take responsibility, take control, do what you can do within the confines of, you know, what the rules are, situation is, whatever, and just do your best. So, you know, I'd probably have a slightly different view on that as well in terms of the vast majority. But, you know, I don't see there's any other way. You can sit and moan or you can just, you know, get up and do something about it.
Yeah, I've wrote down two words here and they might resonate with you. It's called fight or flight, one or the other. You know, it's if you really want something, you have to go get it, Katrina. And I suppose that has been quite synonymous with your story, you know, to date, that really you put yourself in those positions and you really looked at, you know, how you can make advantage of something if you really look and dig deep enough. But your advice, and I suppose there's a caveat here. I know Katrina, I've spoken to her before, but your advice to me, I suppose, one Friday evening was to have a look at your credit card bill. Just looking at some practical advice to give people. Looking at your credit card bill and going through it and just saying, right, let's start here first of all. And then let's see, okay, what you're spending and what you can cut out potentially, you know, as well. So I was going, Jesus, do I spend that much, you know? So obviously this is getting into your finance hat now. You're obviously moving into that space a lot more, with a lot more frequency now. So you give me great advice, but maybe you might tell our listeners some of the stuff that you've given me anyway, on a practical level, first of all, to do.
I'd say on the credit card, as soon as you say credit card to me, I think one very simple thing to do, and I did it, I'd say 6 years ago, I did it just as I started with my mentor. You might not like this, but I'll share it with you anyway. I distinctly remember in our house in Leash, my mentor said it to me and I was like, no, I'm not doing that. She said, get a beer can or a tin can. It has to be tin. Fill it with water. And put your credit card in it and stick it in the freezer. And if you need to use your credit card for any particular reason, you need to take the tin can out and you need to let it defrost. You can't put it in the microwave because it's metal. And so that is your thinking time to, do I really need what it is that I want to put on my credit card? There's no, you know, you can't autofill your credit card. You have to delete all those and physically lock the credit card away in the freezer in a metal container. And I did that. I thought, okay, well, you know, she's telling it to me for a reason. I resisted it. I was like, I don't use my credit card very much. She said, Katrina, just do it. Okay. So I was fine. Good student, did exactly what she said. And I generally forgot about it. There was once or twice I went to do some things. And like she said, by the time I had gotten to the point where the thing was melted and I could have actually used it, I actually didn't really want, I had proper thinking time to work out, did I really want that thing or not? And nine times out of 10, I didn't need it. So I still have a credit card now because it's good from a credit rating point of view and whatnot. But it's very, very rare that I use it. I might use it for flights and stuff because the insurance is better on it, but I just don't use it at all now because, to be honest, I found it more of a pain in the face than anything, because trying to reconcile it then when I was making payments, you know, what pot, because I have pots for everything, what pot it was coming out of was actually a pain. So I very, very rarely use a credit card now because of that, what the challenge that she gave me. And it was...
That's strike one, get rid of the credit card. Okay.
Well, it was tried, and it has to be in a metal tin. And don't be trying to cheat and anything plastic or glass. It has to be metal. I remember putting it in a Carling. My husband had been drinking cans of Carling. So I remember cutting the Carling can in half, filling it up with water and popping it in. And yeah, it did the trick. Anyway, it definitely changed my perspective on using the credit card.
Give us a few more, because I'd like to give back some value to our listeners. I know you've got a mind of value there for it. So, you discussed with me as well about the different pots And maybe you'll explain that again.
Okay, the pots. Well, what I might do is just to give better value, I think maybe if I share the five pillars, which I see as kind of the keys to financial wellness, that better from kind of a macro point of view, and then I can go into, you know, more minute details. But from my perspective and my experience over the last 5 years, getting our own financial stuff in shape, it came down to five key things having in place that were really important to turning our ship around from, you know, barely meeting ends meet to having financial freedom in lined up and in sight. So the first thing was around vision. So making sure that I had a really, really clear, crystal clear vision on what it is that I was building towards. So nothing, you know, it doesn't have to be big or small. It doesn't matter. There's no right or wrong on this. It's whatever you feel is how you would think like things to look when things are exactly set up how you want. And this can change over time and has changed a number of times. And the purpose and the importance behind doing something like that is because when you have those tough days, when you think, oh, I can't be bothered with this, so I'll just buy whatever, you know, and I'm like, I don't really need this, but I'll buy it anyway. You'll find it easier to say no to some of those purchases that you might otherwise just snuck through anyway, because your eyes are on the prize. At your end game is that financial freedom and what it is you want in place. And for me, there's a lot of the things I already have in place, but they can be very simple things. And the best way, there's a great visualization tool on YouTube. It's a free thing from Brian Scott. It's a wealth and abundance manifestation recording. It's about 40 minutes long, and that walks you through the actual process of doing that. So that's really, really good tool to use. So that's the first piece around vision. The second piece then is around tracking. So making sure that, you know, money to me, I feel is like, it's like an energy. So when, and I use it often, the analogy of friendship. So when you're in a space, you have a friend, they're sending you messages or making calls or making arrangements with you. And if you're not turning up, if you don't return the messages, you don't return the calls, you don't show up on time when you're supposed to be meeting them, then that friend is not going to hang around too long. And I think there's a great similarity between friendships and money. So if you don't give leadership guidance and show up for your money in a respectful way, well, then I generally find it doesn't hang around too long, and it comes and it goes. And, you know, it's not a healthy relationship to have. So, you know, taking that idea in terms of the tracking, if you're, you know, going through your receipts, reconciling your bank account, you know where money's going, you have a good idea what's coming in, what's going out, then there's a respectful relationship that you have with money, and it tends to stick around. And as the more you show up for it and lead it as to how you want it to be managed, then it expands in a better way. More money starts coming in, and the money that you have coming in is working harder for you. And that's been my own personal experience of it. So that's the second pillar around tracking. The third one then is really around protection. And this is particularly important, I think, for anybody who has kids, especially young kids. And it's not an easy conversation to have, but it's most definitely a very important one to make sure that you have, where appropriate, life insurance, a serious illness cover, and most definitely a will in place. And, you know, that's something that you would do with a specialized advisor. Make sure, often people are either not insured at all or they're totally overinsured, and make sure you're trying get that happy medium in the middle where you're appropriately insured for what it is you need. Because whilst it's not a pleasant exercise to do, the amount of stories I've heard of people who haven't been insured, especially with young kids, something unforeseeable has happened and it's just been devastating, the consequences. And when something like that happens, it's difficult enough to deal with what's actually happened, never mind having to deal with the financial ramifications that can be caused also in situations like that. So, you know, it's a case of ripping that band-aid off, having that conversation, you know, doing those things and just, you know, dealing with it here and now. The fourth thing then is around debt. And, you know, I would class it as there's good debt and bad debt. Bad debt I would class as consumer debt, things like personal overdrafts, personal loans, credit cards, stuff like that. And good debt I would classify as leverage debt. So debt where you are getting a return on. So say like a rented properties, investment properties, where you have debt on it, but you're servicing the debt well and you're also earning an income on top of that. So to get a sense as to, you know, how much your consumer debt is, to get rid of it as quickly as you can, because it's really just robbing you. and to have a sense as to what your credit score is, because you can often use that to negotiate better rates. And the last piece then, last pillar really to financial wellness, in my opinion, is around getting your savings in order. And the savings piece is quite a big piece I would put into it in terms of future annual stuff. So, you know, expenses that don't come up on a monthly basis, make sure you have provision for that, that you're not kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul, and you have a particular account that covers things like car insurance, tax, whatever, things that come out on an ad hoc basis, Christmas, birthdays, holidays, all those things are provided for. And you know that they're there, you know, when they arise. Another piece then is around, I suppose, if you have kids, you know, having those future saving pots for kids to provide for whatever it is that you'd like to be able to give them. And then the last biggest piece, I think, in savings is really around your pension and making sure that you have in place something that's going to be sufficient for your retirement needs when they arise. And I'm in the camp in terms of pensions. I removed my defined benefits pension from my bank and put it into Davy, actually, to manage it myself. Although I probably shouldn't be talking about Davy. Haven't seen what's happened. How and ever. Hopefully it's safe enough doing its own thing, and I manage it myself at the moment. And so it's having that conversation and making sure, because so many people in terms of pensions specifically hand the power over to somebody else to take care of. And how many times have we been seeing stories in the press all over the place online of people's pensions being absolutely decimated? And it's made out by financial advisors quite often to be super complicated, you know, to manage. It's not. It takes a little bit of knowledge, absolutely. There's a few things to get your head around, but it is not complicated. I took mine out, placed it, it's doing far better. And I took it out of from somebody who's supposed to be a leading pensions provider. And it's like, nah, that's, you can do this and people can do it. So that, they're my five tips in terms of things to get in place to get yourself in better space.
That is fantastic advice, and suppose some of those we'll delve into a bit more. The pensions element, so people, I don't want to seem patronizing here, but the ordinary individual, myself included, pensions was always something I was very scared of, you know, that, geez, I don't need a pension, or, you know, what would I be getting a pension for? I'm 40 this year, so, you know, those scars of buying property when I was younger have come back to affect me whenever I was sorting them all out. So that's your pension gone. But really and truly, suppose through my education base and understanding of how pensions operate, and just when you start to really delve into what am I getting here, is one hand, people can't see, but what am I getting here and what is it going to do for me at the end of it? And every time, suppose me speaking here, straightforwardly, is that every time I went to look, couldn't find the answer, or I couldn't get the return, or I couldn't. Your experience, you know the game more than me. And is that something? Is that a scaremongering tactic, or what is that?
I don't know. I had the exact same experience myself when I went to. My coach was behind me when I was doing it, because I was pooping my pants when I looked into, because everybody said to me, you've got a defined benefits pension. Why on earth would you take that out of a leading pensions provider because you think you can do better? And part of me thought as well, like, who the hell do I think I am to do better, get my pension performing better than the leading pension provider in Ireland? And that little voice was in my head, but equally I had somebody on my, you know, on my side saying, look, ask them for the transfer value. So they were giving me, what my retirement amount was going to be per annum, you know, when at 65. And I thought, oh my God, this is laughable. What a joke. What am I going to do with that? So I asked for the transfer value. I was pleasantly surprised as to what it was. It was significantly more than, you know, what the annual amount was going to be. Obviously, it was going to be higher, but I was surprised as to how much many multiples it was of the annual amount. And then I couldn't find the charges. They kept saying to me, no, there's no charges. There's no charges. And I was like, there are charges, but you've buried them and you've hidden them and called them something else. But as soon as they gave me the annual, the transfer value, I knew. I thought, okay, no, I know. I went into the MoneyChimp calculator and I used the compound interest calculator, and I knew what my average returns would be. If I was to get 8 to 10%, 8% net over the next, I think I was just about to turn 40 when I took it out. Then I put in 8%, 25 years, and saw what it was going to be worth and what I'd be able to get every year. And I was like, oh my God, I can beat them hands down and I can keep my costs under 1%. And whilst they wouldn't tell me what their costs were, I knew that from the performance of what they were going to be able to give me per annum, I could nail that. I could do far better than that. And but even still, with knowledge on my side and somebody highly experienced at my shoulder, you know, advising me on it, I was absolutely petrified taking that money out, because 99% of people told me I was off my head. But I knew and I trusted the person I was working with. She had done it herself. So I moved it out, put it into Davies, and then I had a little spreadsheet based on my risk profile and my age as to how I needed to allocate it. And just single chunk by single chunk, I placed it. It was across four or five different categories, roughly. And, you know, then I left it alone. I made one change to it, really. I had a percentage of it in bonds, which were doing absolutely diddly squat. And when I got more confident myself and saw how it was working and understood the platform better, I cashed in the bonds and said, look, I can do much better in my index trackers. And I threw it into my index trackers and left it there. But in the initial steps, I was terrified, absolutely petrified, because this was the only pension I had. I didn't have any other pension because I had come out of the bank at that stage then, and I was at home, so I hadn't put anything away. So this was my only pension, and if I screwed it up, I was in trouble. But I didn't, and you know, I took advice on it, and now it's blooming. It's doing amazingly well, and I'm very glad that I did, you know, have the balls to take it out and to go against the vast majority of, you know, what people told me, because they weren't right, and my mentor was bang on what she said.
And it's interesting that one. I know it's you could go on about it for ages, you know, but it is, so lifting your head. What I see is lifting your head out of the ground, maybe, and having a look around and seeing there's more opportunity out there. So Katrina, we've covered a lot of things. We've covered COVID, we've covered nearly missing boats, we've covered tears, carbon banking, back around into finance, something that you're very passionate about, and as I say, you give some fantastic tips there for everyone to really look into and to develop. And I suppose that's a passion of mine too, to understand those things, to give value, to actually create value for people, and to get them to understand, to lift their bloody head out of the sand as well when it comes to pensions and also looking after their own wealth. Before we let you go, you have actually started your new business, your property business. Tell us a wee bit more about it and how it works, and why is Katrina so excited about this journey?
Sure. We've started to build our portfolio in the northeast of England. We had our first complete just before last working day before Christmas, December 23rd. We bought the first one for cash, and we desperately wanted to get one over the line before the end of the year. We didn't want to let it creep into 2021. You know, given the year that had been last year, we thought, no, we have to come out as something under, you know, under our belt. So we were absolutely adamant. We pushed that one over, and we were supposed to you know, do it on mortgage, but the mortgage was taking ages, so in the end we just pulled our resources and got enough cash together to get it across the line, so that we knew going into the new year it was possible. You know, we had the tenant in, and we were doing it. So we're working with a partner in the northeast. He's sourcing them for us, and he's managing the refurb, tenanting it, and then letting it. So for us, you know, we had originally planned to, we picked the northeast, you know, back in March last year, and we had planned to travel there in the beginning of April to actually kind of hit the streets and do our own due diligence and whatnot. But this partner in the northeast kind of fell in our laps, and with COVID and not being able to travel, etc., it worked out that it was really a massive blessing in disguise, because had we been able to travel, we were going down the route of creating relationships with estate agents and doing all the hard graft ourselves, which I was totally up for, and you know, I felt I had the skills and competencies to do what I needed. But you know, having it handed to us on a plate where, yes, we had to pay a sourcing fee, but man, in my opinion now, I was totally against it originally, but I feel now it's worth every single penny that we pay him. to take that stress off. And we look after the legals and the finance. And other than that, we have our second and third going through refinancing the first, which is funding the second and third on a commercial mortgage, which we're trying to push over the line before the end of March, because we've got a new 2% tax coming in the UK that we need to get it over. And we have the fourth and fifth lined up. So for us, it's, you know, it's ideal for anybody who wants to get the income and the returns out of property in a hands-off way, who doesn't really want to be pressing the flesh with the estate agents and, you know, traipsing the streets. So it's definitely where my buddy is from Galway. She's a full-time pharmacist. She doesn't have the time, nor the energy, nor the desire to do this. I'm full-time home educator to three, nor do I. So this was the exact perfect fit for us to get that asset class in terms of property ticked and to have it managed by somebody we trusted in the area. And we're looking to build a portfolio kind of 15, 20 size to give us the income that we both need, or both want to get from it. So that's our we're doing something similar on the Isle of Man here as well, but we're working with the same partner in the Northeast, and it's just been easy. I mean, it hasn't been, you know, without its own obstacles, but same deal again. We have our eyes on the prize. We have a very clear vision as to what it is we want to build, and we had that from the outset. So now it's just taking those steps to get where we want to be. So it's very, very exciting, I have to say.
It's a journey that we've been watching, and it's one that you've been so good to share with us this evening on the Breadwinners podcast. Thanks for joining us. If anyone wants to get in contact with you, not just on property, but on different wealth financial elements, how do they do that, Katrina?
They can contact me via LinkedIn or Facebook, just under my name, Katrina Ellis. It's probably the best way to get in contact with me.
I hope today's podcast was useful. Please tag me over on our Facebook page. From myself, Pádraig Kilfertaigh, and the Breadwinner podcast team, we will talk to you in next month's series.